This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to Goodfellas Minute 141.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care.
Hello and welcome to Goodfellas Minute, the only podcast that analyzes the Martin Scorsese picture Goodfellas one my way minute at a time. I am Josh Flanagan. I am with Ron Richards.
You're getting a little accent when he says Scorsese there. By the end of the movie, you're talking with a New York accent. I like it.
I can fake it. And Connor Kilpatrick.
Hello, it's our final week.
It is. And this final week starts with an update on Henry. Where's he at now? And it ends with costume designer Richard Bruno.
So I
love tell you where to get those shirts.
I love this is our moment that we get to dig deep into the credits now.
Start waiting.
One way to
for months.
That's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
For months. Months. There's a flashback for you.
All right, Ron. So
okay, I have another credits for 6 weeks.
All right. So as the coda starts, as we've been calling it, the movie says as of 1990, it says Henry Hill was still in the witness protection program. In 1987, he was arrested in Seattle, Washington for a narcotics conspiracy, and he received 5 years probation. Since 1987, he has been clean.
So for 3 years, he's been clean.
So for 3 years at that point, he's been clean. So whether or not he was clean is open to debate. We know for sure he claims he was clean from 1987 to 2005.
Right.
That's what he claims. He was actually expelled from the witness protection program in the early 1990s due to numerous minor arrests. So
one of them involving a trunk full of fish.
So even though he was in the witness protection program, they did not make it clear that he could not commit crimes. So, yeah. So basically, he was kicked out of the witness protection program in the early 1990s. And then eventually he basically laid low until 2005. And then 2005, things kind of blow up and it's a mess for several years. In 2005, he was arrested in Nebraska because he left his luggage at the airport in North Platte, Nebraska. And when they looked at his luggage, they found glass pipe with cocaine and methamphetamine residue in them. And he was arrested for that. And in September 2005, he was sentenced to 180 days for attempted methamphetamine possession. So that's really got to question
Wait a minute. How do you attempt possession?
Well, because it was
residue. Possession is like a binary thing. It's like you either have it or you don't have it.
It was because it's residue on the pipes. So so he didn't have the meth on him, but he had pipes that clearly were used for using meth.
Feels like attempt is not the right word.
Right.
Listen, we're not lawyers.
I don't know. The Justice Department.
We're not.
Listen, I attempted to possess this meth, and I failed. All right.
We know you attempted it. We can't prove that you did, but we know you attempted it.
Yeah, but so this is a meth about. So he does 180 days in prison for that. And then he gets out, and in 2006, he participates in a photo shoot for Entertainment Weekly, where they did one of those reunion, kind of things. And he does a photo shoot with Ray Liotta.
And he's the criminal that they based it on.
Exactly. And apparently this was the first time that they had interacted in all those years. And 2 days after that photo shoot, Ray Liotta convinced Henry Hill to go to rehab.
Whoa.
Ray Liotta knew a user when he saw one, is what you're saying.
Yeah, clearly Ray Liotta picked up on Henry having some issues. And Henry Hill attributes Ray Liotta 2 days later after that photo shoot, talking to go to rehab. So he goes to rehab. He gets clean again. And then in 2009, he gets 2 years probation for drug-related arrests. And then in December 2009, he's arrested for disorderly conduct and resisting arrest, which he attributed to the fact that he was having drinking problems. Around this time, if you guys remember, in the late 2000s, he really started making appearances in media a lot.
Yep.
He would be on the Howard Stern show quite often, and he would do any documentary that came knocking to talk about it. Like in 2001, he was on the Mob Week special on AMC, where him and other ex-mobsters talked about The Godfather and Goodfellas and stuff like that. And he basically attributed it to that anybody who wanted him dead for testifying against him were dead anyway, so he was safe now.
That's so weird.
Isn't it weird? It's so weird.
It's like one of the enduring mob mysteries.
How he got away with it?
Why they never got back at him.
Yeah. Well, apparently, maybe they just realized that he's getting back at himself. So they just kind of let him self-destruct there. But he entered into various business ventures to try to capitalize on his fame. For a little while he was in Nebraska, right around the attempted methamphetamine possession, he was a chef at an Italian restaurant. He actually packaged his tomato sauce and called it Sunday gravy and sold it on the internet.
Stirring it, though.
Exactly. And then in October 2007, he opened a restaurant in West Haven, Connecticut called Wise Guys. It's just blatant. It's just...
He's sort of like the early reality star, right?
Yeah.
You do whatever you can to capitalize on your name. Any shticky thing.
And we talked about it a little when our friend David was on the show, who knew Henry, but he also sold his paintings on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another area that he was making money. We're going to talk about what happened with him and Karen next, but spoiler, they separated. And he actually spent the last 14 years of his life with the same woman, his girlfriend, Lisa Caserta. And she confirmed on June 12, 2012, one day after he turned 69, that he passed away in a hospital in Los Angeles. And the quote she gave to CBS News from Lisa Caserta was that he'd been sick for a long time. His heart gave out. He went out pretty peacefully for a good fella. And the truth behind it was that he suffered a heart attack. And then he suffered a heart attack right before his death. And that he died from complications from the longtime heart problems related to smoking.
And I'm sure cocaine.
I'm sure methamphetamine. Meth. Meth. So, and then he was cremated the day after he passed away. So Henry's story
That's
ends.
That's the story.
Yeah.
I mean, let's, you know.
Yeah, so he continued a life of crime and a life of wrestling with substances, and it's funny because like I always separated the real Henry Hill from the Henry Hill that we see depicted in this movie.
Well,
because I feel like the real Henry Hill was just a kind of a loser, you know. I don't know.
I think Ray Liotta plays one. He's just better looking.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, like him using his name to cash in. I mean, wouldn't like his whole life was about doing whatever you could, you know, scrape up anything to cash in on something,
make money.
And
right.
And the easiest thing to do would be to use the fame that he ended up with himself.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes sense. He's not even hurting anybody doing that. It's not like it's more shameful than robbing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that sense.
And he was on a lot of there are a lot of documentaries produced between 2010 and 2012 that he was in.
Yeah.
He was in the one about, we talked about it, that was about the point shaving.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
That was narrated by Ray Liotta.
Yeah. Let's not only give Henry Hill a tough time about this.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of, there's a lot of times where Ray Liotta could be like, I think I'm good with that.
Yeah. I just feel sad. I feel like this the story of Henry Hill is riddled with mistakes and
yeah.
problems. It's just sad.
I don't know that it's... Is it sad? Like really? I mean, that's a big question, but like, yeah. is it sad or is it sort of like apropos? Like, he could have gone... It could have been a lot worse.
Yeah. I don't know. Just, right. I mean, at what point, I mean, how old, so he's 69 in 2012. So how old is he in 2005? He's, that's 7 years. So he's 62 smoking meth.
Yeah, that's sad. Just because he had, I mean, what he had was a real opportunity to be a thing.
Right.
You know, and to actually turn his life around, but he probably had no capability to do that. Wouldn't know how to live that. The whole movie's about how he doesn't know how to live like normal people anyway.
Yeah.
Normal people don't live like this.
Yeah, I just think it's sad.
Ron's missing the romance and the grandeur of the mafia death.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a heart attack in a hospital because he was doing drugs. Like, that's sad. Like, of course he had heart problems related to smoking. No, it was related to the cocaine and meth.
All of it. I mean, I'm not sure the smoking.
And the drinking, all
yeah.
of it. Yeah.
And the drinking, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. All right.
It's not like he was out there jogging.
Should we move on?
Hustling. Yes, just move on.
All right, so the next credit, the next coda text that we get in beautiful Helvetica says, in 1989, Henry and Karen Hill separated after 25 years of marriage. So they did not last. This is the only little bit about Karen in the end coda, and there's not a lot about Karen in the real world. She has kept her privacy post-witness protection program.
She's the only one still alive, right?
Yeah, yeah. So they separated in 1989. They did not get divorced until 2002.
Interesting.
Yeah, and at some point they were living together again in Rockville Center on Long Island in the late 90s. But then eventually separated, and Henry shacked up with Lisa, and she moved on.
It's hard to resist the allure of Long Island, isn't it, Ron?
Well, listen, Rockville Center was home for them.
Everybody eventually comes home.
Exactly. I had an Uber driver who was from Rockville Center the other day. So there you go.
did you talk about it?
We did. I asked him if he knew Henry. He didn't. No. So as far as I know, she's still alive. She continues to use an alias, though. She's
smart.
Protecting her identity, as do her children. So their children change their names. And actually, what's also interesting, which I saw this is in the Wikipedia listing for Karen. I didn't realize that the Hill children released a book in 2004 called On the Run, A Mafia Childhood.
Interesting. And, you want to read that now, don't you?
I kind of do. And the book depicts the children named Greg and Gina discuss how their grandparents on – so Karen's parents, how their grandparents on Karen's side – and Karen's two younger sisters, Cheryl and Ellen, who are not in the movie at all, by the way. I thought the movie makes it look like Karen's an only child.
Right.
But she had sisters, apparently.
Well, Henry had a brother that was not in the movie either.
Yeah, no, yeah. And they had a son, which wasn't in the movie either. They just showed two daughters, remember? But so apparently they reminisce about the fact that their grandparents and aunts helped take care of them while Karen and Henry were out doing what they did.
Drugs?
Yeah. So there you go. That's all I got on Karen.
All
so
right.
Who knows where she is today?
Probably listening.
Do you think?
God, no.
If you're Karen Friedman Hill and you're listening to this podcast, please write us at contact at goodfellowsminute.com.
We don't have to tell anyone.
Yeah,
if that's a thing. You know what? If you're anybody, not anybody, but, you know, somebody.
Just email us and just say yes, I'm listening, and we won't respond. We'll respect your privacy, but just give us a sign.
We don't want an interview. We want validation. I mean, that's what it is.
That's all it is.
We're not going to get it.
Moving on in the coda, it says Paul Cicero died in 1988 in Fort Worth Federal Prison of respiratory illness. He was 73. That is correct, although his real name was Paul Vario. He died on May 3rd, 1988. He was at Fort Worth Federal Prison. He was in the midst of serving a 10 to 12 year sentence for all the convictions that were tied to Henry testifying against him. And he is currently buried at St. John Cemetery in Middle Village, Queens.
You kind of want to visit it, don't you?
I thought about it, I'll be honest with you. Would that be weird? Is that weird? All right. Then the next one is Jimmy Conway is currently – now, this is as of 1990 when the movie came out.
Yep.
Jimmy Conway is – Yeah, is currently serving a 20 years to life sentence for murder in a New York State prison. He will not be eligible for parole until 2004 when he will be 78 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys think he made it to 2004?
No.
He did not.
No, I didn't. Yeah,
not
no.
that lifestyle.
Yeah. So basically what happened was, this was really interesting as I looked into it. I didn't realize as we were going into it. He initially got arrested in 1980 for a parole violation. That's how they got him. They got him for associating with a known felon.
Aren't they all?
I know, exactly. And then in 1982, he received the 12-year sentence for the part he played in the Boston point-shaving scandal, of which Henry Hill testified. And so he was doing 12 years for that. And then while he was in prison, he was then also tried and convicted for the murder of Richard Eaton related to Lufthansa. For that, he received 20 years to life. He was serving his time at the Wendy Correctional Facility in Alden, New York. And then he came down with cancer, with either lung cancer or stomach cancer. And he died on April 13th, 1996 in Buffalo, New York at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute. And what's interesting is that he died in the month that his lawyer had scheduled a motion to grant him parole or free him, basically, on grounds that his civil rights had been violated.
Wait, what year did he die?
1996.
So do you think he saw the movie?
Oh, that's a good question. Are they allowed to see movies in prison?
Oh, yeah, they show movies
in
prison.
Yes, sure.
So, yeah, probably 6 years.
You think that they would show Goodfellas, though?
Because
it's, you know, could rile them up, I guess. Like, they get to see, like, Herbie the Love Bug. They don't get to see that.
I feel like seeing Herbie the Love Bug would make them angrier.
Yeah.
What is this shit?
Here's a good question. Let's say you're in prison, mm-hmm. and it's Friday night movie night.
Yep.
And they put in Goodfellas, and right. you've never seen it before, but you're like, oh, it's about crits like us, whatever. And then they get to the prison scene with fucking Bobby Darin playing. They're making tomato sauce.
Another reason it's a bad movie to show.
Right. Yeah. That's a good question. If you work in a correctional facility, can you listen to the show, email us at contact@goodfellasminute.com and let us know if you'd show Goodfellas in a movie. This one,
I think we've got a shot on.
Well, I think it's also different because the person in the prison is a character in the movie, so that's a different consideration than just any old gangster film.
Like, do you think he got a private show, a private viewing?
With Henry?
No. Yeah, no, Henry came to visit him, and he brought the VHS tape. And he's like, all right, we're going to sit down, you behind the glass, and me right here, we're going to watch this together for the most awkward 2 hours ever. The
best video commentary.
And do you think that Jimmy actually watches the movie or just bores holes through the back of Henry's head with his eyes?
Right. And you choose that, like, so that's like audio option 6 on the DVD, and it's just like, mother you.
That's a good question. Do you think the last time Henry saw these guys was when he was testifying, or do you think he ever went to visit them in prison?
No.
Absolutely, the last time he saw them was in that courtroom.
Yeah. That's awkward.
So who do you think was angrier? Was it Paulie or Jimmy?
Jimmy, according to the character in the movie.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a good question, because Paulie didn't want to go out like Gribbs, and he did.
Nobody wants to go out like Gribbs.
Well, yeah, but no. He specifically said, that's not going to be me, and it was him.
That's the thing about destiny.
Yeah. It's rough. All right, well, that's the coda. That wraps up what happened to all the key players after the movie came out.
All right. Let's talk about what we're listening to.
Okay.
This actually started at the end of the last minute, and it's Sid Vicious's version of My Way. My Way, of course, popularized by Frank Sinatra, but he did not write it. It was written by Paul Anka, and it was actually based on the melody of a French song called Comme d'habitude. That was 1967 when that Paul Anka heard the song, and he's like, that album was terrible, but I like the melody. He bought the rights to it because he liked it. He wanted to do something with it. And then Anka was having dinner with Frank Sinatra and, quote, a couple of mob guys. And Sinatra told him, I'm quitting the business. I'm sick of it. I'm getting the hell out. So then Anka went and he rewrote the French lyrics for Sinatra, changing it a little bit, putting in the lyrics, and because he wrote them the way that he thought Frank would say it. So, like, things like, I ate it up and spit it out. Like, he's like, I wouldn't have said that, but Frank said it. And he called Frank and said, I got this song for you, and he recorded it. And so in 1969, that became, I think it was number 7. It became a big hit, because I tend to think of it as an older song, but it's actually a very late era Frank Sinatra song.
Yeah, way, yeah.
And he hated it.
Really?
The song?
By the end, yeah. He wouldn't perform it anymore.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
In 1978, as we were witnessing the end of the Sex Pistols, Sid Vicious did a solo project, and this was one of the songs
the Sid
on
Vicious
it.
Experience?
He performed the Sid Vicious, yeah. It was a single first. It actually, this single actually made it to number 7 in the UK. He did a lot of sessions, but it's actually no Sex Pistols players on this. It's all French session players. The overdubbed solo from Steve Jones, the guitarist from the Sex Pistols. He changed the lyrics around a little bit. He said something about a guy in a hat. He was talking about Johnny Rotten.
And he added some more colorful language, right?
Some swearing. Yeah, some things like that. You can hear it at the end of the Great Rock and Roll Swindle, the sort of film sort of about the Sex Pistols.
Wait, what year was this song recorded?
78.
So who was angrier, Jimmy going to prison or Frank Sinatra hearing this?
Or Paul Anka.
No, I'm thinking Sinatra.
Paul Anka heard it. He didn't mind it. He respected it for a thing. He didn't like it, but he was like, I get it. It's a thing.
What is the quote? Look at the quote here. He said, Paul Anka said, quote, I was somewhat destabilized by the Sex Pistols version.
Not the Sex. See, he said the Sex Pistols version. That's wrong.
Yeah.
That would be better.
What does he know?
So what's interesting to me about this, hey, the fact that it's French session players is funny to me. I'm not sure why. Because I just, like, it sounds like a Sex Pistols song. And they just found, like, a random guy named Jean-Paul to be like, can you play a Les Paul like that? And he's like, sure. I mean, you know, it's funny because I was thinking about it and it's so on the nose why this is in here. Like it's a Frank Sinatra song, more or less. And as we get to the end of the movie, when the whole dream of this thing is shattered, you get this like disturbing, messed up version that is sort of caterwauled out. It's like a perfect metaphor.
Yeah.
As we've discovered throughout the show, much of the music is on the nose.
Yeah. Super on the nose. I hate the beginning of this song. Like it really bothers me.
Really? Why?
It's not in the strings part where he's like sounds all mealy mouth.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like the way that he sings it really bothers me. I ended up going down a Sid Vicious rabbit hole.
Oh God, I've been down that hole. That's a dangerous hole to go down.
At any point did you do heroin while you were down that hole?
It was attempted.
I was trying to buy heroin. I bought meth.
Attempted to possess it.
There's the legend that Sid Vicious couldn't play. There's like a quote that you hear from Steve Jones. I was like, we couldn't play and he couldn't sing. And then they bring in Sid and they were like, we didn't even plug Sid in because he was so terrible. But the other side of the story is that he couldn't play. But like if he wanted to learn something, he would put his entire effort behind it. So like he stayed up all night learning the first Ramones record. You know, he did a bunch of speed to do it. But at the end of it, he could play that, you know, and he did that. But he didn't know what he was doing. You know,
he got added to the Sex. He got added to the Sex Pistols because of his look. You know,
The other half of it is they always said, you know, Steve Jones would say like the Sex Pistols couldn't play, and I'm like, no, they could. They were very good players.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's so funny. I love that. There's a quote. I'm looking at Sid Vicious's Wikipedia page, and there's a quote where Sid Vicious went to Lemmy, the bassist of Motorhead, and asked him to teach him how to play bass. And he said the words, "quote unquote, I can't play bass." To which Lemmy replied, "I know." Oh God.
So do we have anything on the credits? The actual credits here?
The people.
A couple of, yeah.
Yeah, well, our first credit is the director of photography, Michael Ballhaus.
Yeah, a German.
Who's a legend and also a long-time Scorsese collaborator and passed away.
He has 119 cinematography credits, and he's been doing Scorsese movies since, I just had After Hours, 1985.
Yeah,
he went to The Color of Money. He did Last.
What I find interesting. Yeah. So he did. So he did Color of Money, Last Temptation of Christ, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah.
Right.
It's always great when you look at a really successful cinematographer because their stuff's all over the place. Like they're like, you have a check? I will do this.
Well, it's their job.
The Legend of Bagger Vance.
It was a beautifully shot movie.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah. He did Gangs of New York, which was, for all its failings, a beautiful movie. Did the last major movie he did was The Departed.
You pronounced it wrong.
Padded. He did Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
Or I pronounced it wrong. Dracula.
If we're going to go through all these names, we're going to be here for another 10 years.
I'm going to pick out a couple.
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm totally wrong. He's not dead. He lives in Germany.
No, I didn't think.
He lives in Berlin.
He's not dead. He lives in Germany, : the Michael Ballhaus story. I picked out Christy Z, who is the production designer, who I just looked at what she'd done. And the last thing that she did was Robert De Niro's The Intern. So, you know, still keeping it up.
Nice. With
working
Niro.
With De Niro on some of
his more. Connor, I agree with you. We can't do every name, but I feel like these are the big names. These are you can tell they're important because they get their own title card. I mean, like the next name is Thelma Schoonmaker.
And that's the last one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Thelma, we've mentioned many times in this. She's the editor of every one of Scorsese's movies since 1980's Raging Bull. She's 76 now, which means that she did The Wolf of Wall Street, which just watching that makes me tired. So that's impressive that what it would have been 73-year-old woman made that movie look as fresh and sort of contemporary as she did.
Mm-hmm.
Her story is that she met Martin Scorsese way, way, way back during a summer program at New York University where she was taking an editing course. She had some experience editing movies, and she came in to help student director Scorsese with some problems on his film. But she didn't have a union card, so she couldn't. He'd wanted her to work on his stuff the whole time, but she couldn't until finally 1980, he got her in.
Cool.
I love the collaborative nature of, like, when you look at those movies, like, he's had this person with him all along. Yeah. You know, since way, way, way back. And that really has a huge thing to do with, you know, there's nobody else that he's worked with every single time.
There's a huge level of trust between a director and an editor.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not uncommon for that to happen. He has to know that she's going to capture his vision and not going to mess it up.
Right.
She's a gigantic part of this movie, too.
There's one credit name that I would like to call out here before we move on. The second assistant director, Vibe Borgia.
Nice.
That's V-E-B-E. Borgia, as in Victor Borgia.
Pardon me, madam, but did you lay an egg?
He has had a great career as a first and second assistant director throughout his entire career. He worked on Goodfellas. He worked on The Talented Mr. Ripley. He worked on Glory. He worked on some great movies. But Connor,
yes,
he also has had a lovely career more recently as the first assistant director on not one, but two Law & Order.
Great!
So there you go. So,
he didn't do the full Law & Order though.
He doesn't have the full Law & Order trifecta. He's only got Law & Order SVU and regular Law & Order.
Lived in New York. What I got out of that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I'll accept it.
Most recently, he was the first assistant director on The Leftovers, that TV series in 2014. So there you go. Okay. That's all I got for the credits.
I think that'll do for our
VBE Borgia
Michael. Ballhouse.
This is where we normally would talk about a fun fact or the fuck count, but since the movie's over, we don't have those anymore. Instead, what I did was I sent a little short questionnaire to our guests, all the people that have been nice enough to come on our show, and I asked them a question about the film, and I thought it'd be fun to see what they said, but also, you know, give our own answers. So for the first question, it was, name your three favorite characters from the movie.
Wow.
Now,
good question.
Many votes. Not everyone was able to respond in time. I did not give them enough time. I thought of this late, but I got a quorum. I got a majority of the guests to respond.
You're a real jerk. You know that?
A majority of the guests responded. So
six fucking emails you wasted on this show.
The top three favorite vote getters were Jimmy, Tommy, and a tie for third place between Karen and Carbone.
Yes, Carbone. I was pulling for Carbone. Okay.
Karen,
of all people.
Yes. Huh. I'll tell you mine. Ed McDonald.
Okay.
He's a late comer.
He's finishing strong. He finishes strong. Sonny Buns.
Okay.
I struggled with this
last
one.
Come on.
Well.
Come on, you struggled.
I did because I...
Don't give me that Johnny Roast Beef shit.
You could go Johnny Roast Beef. I really wanted to go Carbone.
You went Frenchy.
No, I went. I had to go obvious. I had to go Tommy.
Wow.
He's electric on the screen every time he's on the screen.
It's true.
Tommy is not my top three.
All right.
Favorites tough.
My three favorites are Frenchy, Carbone, and Henry.
Interesting. All right.
Maybe Jimmy. Fuck.
It's hard, right? Or Pauly.
I'm sorry, I'll replace... Oh, Pauly. Oh, it's got to be Pauly. I'm sorry. It's Frenchy, Carbone, and Pauly.
Wow. Interesting.
Josh? Carbone?
Number one with
Carbone,
a bullet.
Carbone, Jimmy, Maury.
Maury was one I considered as well.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not favorite. Like, I like that guy the most, yeah. But I like when they're on, when Maury's on, the movie's tense as hell.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Whenever Maury's on screen, you're like, oh, shit.
My number one is Pauly, number two, Carbone, number three, Frenchy. Okay, there you go.
In addition to these question answers, I might give additional commentary by Gabriel Hardman because he not only answered the questions,
No one's complaining.
He gave detailed answers and paragraphs-long explanations.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
But his three favorite characters were Ed McDonald, and he wrote it as Edward McDonald as Agent Edward McDonald. Catherine Scorsese's mother as Tommy's mother.
Oh,
Catherine Scorsese as Tommy's mother. And Joe Pesci as Tommy DeVito. So I feel good about my Tommy all choice. Right.
Those are all good answers. There's no bad answers.
No, there's an abundance. Yeah. I mean, how can you not love Johnny Roast Beef?
Can you forward us Gabe's treaties on these? Because I would like to know. I would like to see the full paragraph about everybody.
He didn't do it for this one, but for the other answers, there's paragraphs.
Oh, great. Excellent.
We'll get to the other answers later in the week. But those are the three favorite characters. From the guests, it was Jimmy, Tommy, Karen, and Carbone tied for third. And then those are ours. So there you go. So those were the three favorite characters from the film.
All right. Cool. This is a long one, guys.
Yeah.
It's like we don't want it to end.
Are we still
doing two?
We still got work to do, right,
yeah,
Josh?
Still got work. It. Yeah. So some of the most important people to the show are not just the guests, but they're the patrons, the folks who go over to patreon.com/GFM and they pledge to support the show. And if you pledge a certain level, you get a mob name, and we got a backlog. We got to get through this week. Running out of time. We got to do it.
So we're going to do it every episode this week because we have somebody to get through.
Yeah, so do we have our first name today?
We do.
Sean German.
Oh. We already did the Kaiser.
Yeah.
Sean German.
Crowdhead.
You know, what's funny is that it's immediately... Well, it's making me think of The Godfather. That's my Kraut Mick friend, Sean German. Right there.
Kraut Mick?
Wait, so...
Mick Kraut? No, Kraut Mick.
Hagen.
Mickey Kraut.
Mickey Kraut. Mickey Kraut. Ooh. Ooh.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Is that okay? I don't know if that's okay. Mickey the Kraut.
We don't have a German on the show right now. We can't be like, oh, Ron's here. We can say whatever.
Mickey the Kraut.
I like Mickey Kraut.
Mickey Kraut.
Mickey Schnitzel?
Well, that's the whole point is it's a Godfather quote.
Right.
Kraut. Well, he's a Kraut. Yeah.
Because we would be quoting The Godfather all the time, right?
Mickey Kraut.
Mickey Kraut. All right. There we go. All right. So the mafia name generator for Sean German is no-brainer Fabiano.
Nope.
Nope. We won that one.
Next.
All right, next name?
Jarrett Gossett.
Jarrett Gossett.
That's a made-up name at first, right?
Yeah.
That's like, it's just supposed to be a D.
That's what the mafia name generator gave him.
Yeah.
Jarrett Gossett.
Sounds like a lawn game.
Four T's.
Four T's.
Okay, hold on. T. Gossett. The goose? Just the goose?
Because it sounds like gossage.
Like, that's better? Gossage? You're trying to say sausage.
Goose Gossage was the pitcher in the Yankees.
Which is funny because I don't think Josh, did you know who Goose Gossage is? Or?
No.
Like, how did you make that reference?
I didn't. I just said the goose. You said Gossage.
I thought you were saying the goose. Where did you get the goose?
I got from a goss. It sounds like Gosling.
So it wasn't the fact that there was a pitcher named Goose Gossage.
No. What team was he on?
The Yankees.
That would have been late 80s.
No, early 80s.
I remember that. So that was in my baseball card.
That was in your subconscious. That came out of your subconscious, I think.
No, it's because my kids have books where they have Goslings in them, and that's what it made me think.
I like four T's.
Four T's.
He's got two T's in his first name, two T's in his last name.
Four T's.
Double T's.
That's not double. That's quad T.
Quad T. That's too much thinking.
That's a terrible nickname.
Green T.
That's too much thinking.
I like the goose.
I'm going to say the goose.
I'll
go with the goose.
All right. They would have been Yankee fans, so that's fine.
All right. And so the mafia name generator for Jarrett Gossett is Bugly Eyes Fabiano.
Again with the Fabiano.
I don't know what's wrong with the Fabiano. I'm gonna hit the side of the generator. I'm gonna reboot it. All right, so there you go. Sean German, Jarrett Gossett, also known as Mickey Kraut and the Goose.
Mickey Kraut and the Goose is a great title.
that's their sitcom.
That's a great title. Well, Mickey Kraut's here, but where's the Goose? I don't know. The Goose is always with Mickey Kraut. That's weird, right? I don't know. I don't like it. So that is going to do it for 141. I was writing a show in my head there. Come back tomorrow for 142. Until then, you can check us out on Twitter at GoodfellasMin or Instagram or Facebook at GoodfellasMinute. And, of course, you can find all of our episodes, all of the 140 we have done before this, at GoodfellasMinute.com. If you do want to still support the show, you can certainly still go to GoodfellasMinute.com/support and shop via our Amazon link and you can pledge to Patreon all you want. that would be fine with me. If you have any questions, anything you want to ask about, tell us. Contact at goodfellowsminute.com. And that'll do. We will be back here for 142 tomorrow.
Or will I go from rags to riches? My fate is up to you.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also like, one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.